Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Horticulture Week podcast. I'm Rachel Forsyth, senior reporter at Hort Week, and today I'm joined by Lynn Marcus. Lynn has been designing gardens since 1997, starting her own garden design practice in 2006, with her portfolio ranging from the contemporary to the classic, from the large-scale gardens to small courtyards. Lynn was also appointed chair of the Society of Garden Designers in 2020, which will be holding a two-day symposium on the 9th and 10th of June to address the deepening climate crisis and explore the positive impact garden and landscape design can have on the environment. So a huge welcome to Lynn.
Thank you.
I thought we could just sort of kick off by asking you what your favourite current design trends are at the moment.
I guess my current design trend favourites are all based on natural gardens, that we are actually looking at our gardens as spaces that are actually gardens rather than massive rooms with lots of kitchens and all sorts of fandangle stuff in them, and that we actually go outside and enjoy the space as a garden rather than as just another room in the house. And that seems to be very much the trend everywhere at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to dive in with a topic that I know you're very passionate about. I think it's quite safe to say we're at a critical point where climate change is concerned. So I'm really interested to know how that's having an impact on the way that you design gardens at the moment.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because actually, clients still really want the same things. They still want to go outside in their garden. They want to enjoy their garden. They want to have their play spaces for their children. And they want places to hang out and relax with friends. So the big trick is to be able to facilitate all of those things and still facilitate biodiversity, pollination, and all the other things that we are all holding so dear and are so very important. And my feeling about it is always really now that we have a duty to take our clients with us. And we have to be client central, but we also have to, in the process of designing the garden, go step by step and encourage our clients to want the same things we do, which is basically approaching the garden from a let's see what we can keep perspective. Let's have a light touch with it and let's recycle as much as we can. Use as little concrete as possible, make sure everything is completely porous and that our planting is naturalistic, but actually also appropriate for where we are in the United Kingdom.
And how are your clients responding to this approach? Are they quite on board with the sustainable, environmentally friendly gardens, or do you ever find yourself having to really encourage them to get on board?
Funny enough, I did have a client the other day say to me, can I have a barbecue? Have you got anything against those? Which is quite funny, actually. And I actually had to bite my tongue. So of course not. We do all have to go out and do these things in our gardens, but we have to be just mindful because we're just the stewards of the space that we own in our outside our houses. And I find that when we go through the process, clients become quite compliant. They all have young children. They're all aware, well, they don't all have young children. Lots of them have young children. And they're all desperately aware of the state we're in and actually begin to want to contribute to trying to do something about it. But the other really positive thing, I think, is that if you plant and you build a garden, build and plant a garden with sustainability in mind, quite often it can be quite a lot cheaper. And that is always going to grab the client where it really matters, which is they can have a lovely garden and it might well cost them less money.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you have any advice to garden designers trying to navigate this with their clients? Do you have any sort of tricky experiences that you've kind of had to navigate?
Tricky experiences? No. I mean, there are things that they think they want that you have to persuade them against. I mean, there are the sort of more sophisticated part of it, which is really, you know, build with as few walls as possible, which is easily said if you've got a bigger space. But if you're in a small urban space, in a hilly area, like I live in Muswell Hill, it's quite difficult because gardens aren't that big. But what you don't want are lots of terracing and walls, which are hugely intrusive. So you try and slope the soil as much as possible, as few drains as possible, so that all hard surfaces drain into planting, as many porous surfaces as possible. So that's all great. The problems arise when people want massive outdoor sort of cooking areas, my big bête noire is artificial grass, which I think should be made illegal, but only that area. And normally I manage to persuade clients away from it because it's just such a dangerous product.
Yeah, I've heard you speak about your your sort of arguments against this before. Yeah. Do you think that's the biggest issue in the industry currently?
No, there are lots of issues, but if you sort of have a pyramid of horrors, I do not understand how clients, or how anyone rather, forget clients, how anyone thinks that they can't take a bag at the supermarket, but it's all right to cover all of their outside space with plastic. And I don't really understand why these connections aren't being made. And the only reason I can think they're not being made is really, really good marketing that tries to avoid these points. I mean, many, many companies are addressing the issue of, you know, recycling the plastic because the plastic has been non-recyclable because it's multi-polymer. But they're not addressing all the other issues in that basically you're creating a complete dead zone in your garden.
And in terms of other things that you may have adapted for climate change reasons, what about planting? Are you sort of trying to think about that a bit more, future-proofing, things like that?
Well, I've always planted with a very high proportion of soft landscaping. And I work in a lot of areas which are conservation areas which demand it. You have to have permission to do stuff in your garden and they want at least 60% soft landscaping. I've also worked in areas where the local councillor says they want predominantly native plants, which is fantastic, except that that is anything that was actually standing at the end of the last ice age and has naturally occurred subsequently. So it does limit your choices. But that isn't future-proofing it for climate change, because a lot of them aren't going to survive terribly well. So, yeah, you can future-proof, but what you can't do is say, well, guess what? You know, I'm in the middle of London and I'm just going to stick a load of Mediterranean silverleaf plants in because then they'll be fine, because they will not, because they will not necessarily be happy to grow in clay. And if you are going to grow these plants in somewhere like in London on a clay basin, then you have got to do an awful lot more to your garden to make that possible by creating free-draining soil. And then you are just compounding the problem because you're importing lots of materials, which is exactly what you don't want to do. So I think probably the answer is to start limiting our pallets and looking far more closely and carefully about where we are in the country. So what I can grow in London, you can probably, you'll be able to grow something completely different in the west of Scotland or in Cornwall. And I just think we have to look more carefully at our own planting palettes.
Yeah, and where do you think this needs to lead from? Is it going to come from garden designers? Does it need to be a whole industry effort, including sort of artificial grass and, you know, you're wanting to reduce that usage?
Well, I think garden design, well, members of the SGD are pretty much on board with this. I mean, that's what the symposium is all about. We are looking at ways forward together. In order to do something about artificial grass, I mean, we banned it from all our our advertising and sponsorship and everything 3 years ago now, and remain the only body to have done so. And it's a very difficult thing, isn't it? It cost, you know, the Garden Design Journal quite a bit of money, but after a year or so, we found other people to replace advertisers. So it is entirely possible. But I think it's an industry-wide effort, to be honest. And I think it has to come from landscapers as well as garden designers, because there are always landscapers advertising, installing it. And I think people just simply have to start taking a stand on it.
And what do you think is holding people back at the moment?
It's lucrative.
Yeah. And
do you want to screw up that?
No, I want your honest opinion.
I don't know. And also, it's not just that. It's just that for some reason, people haven't made the connection. And I don't understand why the public at large hasn't made the connection. And neither do I understand how government isn't prepared to legislate. And I know they don't like to legislate against these things. But the reality is that they legislate against, you know, single-use plastic bottles and supermarket bags, as I've said. So I would put this on the same par, except it's even more dangerous because, you know, it stops any animal from being involved, and also it heats up to such an extent that it creates urban heat islands. So, but none of these issues are examined at all. Although I do believe finally there's some research going into it now.
Mm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go off on one just about artificial grass. But if you're looking at a list of things that are the most damaging that we're putting in our gardens, I think this has to be number one.
And what are some of those other issues that we need to address in terms of climate change?
Climate change or sustainability or both?
I guess both, yeah.
Water use. Use of irrigation. It's quite hard without also working, especially on new builds, working with architects and how they're draining from buildings, or if they're putting in basements, where is all the water going? There are lots of issues that where I think we have to work as an industry together with people who are designing the outside space, along with people who are designing the house and the inside space. So it's not just down to people working on the outside, so to speak. But I did a project recently, and I went through with a drainage engineer, because it's a very big project, and we stripped up pretty much every drain. There was not necessary, except belts and braces around the house, because of flash flooding. It wasn't necessary to have any drains at all in the garden. So everything drains into planting. And then the next thing is to make sure that you're not overusing irrigation systems. In fact, I did a project in Sussex, which is seriously hot and dry and free draining, and we didn't put irrigation in at all, and we've had virtually no casualties, just a few, and that's fantastic. It's just by, you know, after a year or so, most plants should be able to survive quite happily with the occasional bit of watering without actually installing massive irrigation systems and top up tanks with mains water top up, which I think is unacceptable now. It's becoming unacceptable. And the other thing is using very large plants. I can't see how importing a huge tree on the back of one truck all the way, then to be lifted over a house with a crane, to be moved with a telehandler, and then for someone to dig a big hole with a digger and then to put that tree in, is actually saying, well, it's a sensible carbon capture. It's not. You've expended so much carbon just getting that tree into place. So we have to think about smaller trees. We have to, you know, a tree that one person can carry over their shoulder into the garden. We have to use smaller trees. They're better at carbon capture. And really importantly, they need less water and they adapt far faster to their circumstances. We just have to go back a little bit, look to the past, I think, and look to what we used to do before so much was readily available.
So a lot of the future of garden design will be looking back.
Well, that is what the symposium is about, of course.
I mean,
we're not entirely about that, but it's largely looking at, you know, for goodness sake, for hundreds of years, people have been building wonderful gardens without all this stuff that we have, and without using massive plants and just waiting for them to grow. I mean, I was on the motorway the other day on Sunday and looking at all the huge, the warehouses for all the big distribution companies. I'll try and not all use all their names, but they're obvious, you know, Amazon and so forth. Massive, massive warehouses. And some of them have done nothing. And some of them have actually put tons and tons of tree saplings in. And you think, oh gosh, at least they're trying to make an effort. I mean, thinking about everything that we do, I mean, all the roofs could be turned into farms or places to grow plants or anything. But all the things that we do, we need to be thinking about every time we put a building up. I think we've got to be thinking much more about being green-led rather than greenwashing, and do it for real.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you've mentioned the Society of Garden Designers Symposium a few times. What do you hope is going to come from that symposium? I know that you're working on a future aesthetic.
Yes, I mean, I don't want to predetermine it. I think when we talk about the Society of Garden Designers, it's us. I mean, it's all of our 1,900 members. We are us. It's not, you know, council, or it's not the speakers. And hopefully what's going to come from it is a collaborative thought process. I mean, we do have breakout sessions. So the idea being that we can start working or thinking together as groups. I hope that there will be lots of other people other than garden designers there, suppliers and landscapers who, after all, we can't build our gardens without them. So I hope that we will all be thinking together about the way forward. The idea is for us to produce a manifesto for the future, but I really don't want to predetermine what that is other than all of the issues that we've been discussing today, I'm hoping will be addressed.
Mm. And where will that sort of be shared if it does come to light?
It'll be shared on the SGD website. It'll be shared as a newsletter. It'll be shared as a press release. It'll be shared wherever we can manage to share it. I might even send a copy to DEFRA.
Hopefully it's something the government can get behind.
Well, I hope so, yeah.
And in terms of working with your clients at the moment, what are some of the things that are really coming out trend-wise?
My entire garden design approach is about the house or the building and the environment it's in. Mm-hmm. And that is the only trend that I'm really, really interested in the sense that, you know, obviously you're led by the client taste. So, and that varies, you know, depending on who they are and what their taste is. So it can be more contemporary, it can be more classic, it can be more arts and crafts, it can be less arts and crafts, it can be whatever the, you know, that's the point, isn't it? It's a client brief, and the client actually says roughly what they want, normally not in a great deal of detail, actually. You have to read between the lines, spend a lot of time looking at their home and what their hopes and wishes are, and then try and turn that into some sort of reality. But to be honest, I think it always relates to the house. I always try and use British stone. I can't locally source it, sadly, because we don't have too many quarries in London. But when I'm working in London, that is. But I do source it locally if I'm out of London. And that basically, I just think the whole thing needs to gel as a piece. And I always have felt that. And, you know, if you're standing in a London garden and you can see a borrowed view, or if you're standing in a Sussex garden, you can see the downs. It's about where that garden is. So I'm not really very good on trends. It's, you know, to me, if the client likes a particular kind of garden sofa, well, that's fine. That's up to them. That's their choice. It's not the kind of thing that I get particularly hung up about. I'm more hung up about how levels and geometry and everything relates back to the house itself and out to the wider environment.
Yeah, wonderful. So my last question for you is, what plant would you take to a desert island?
So do I have to assume it's a desert island that's tropical, or is it in the Hebrides, or is it in South Georgia? So obviously my answer would be that it would need to be able to survive in its environment and not be a threat to the indigenous planting. So biosecurity would be, you know, so apart from that, to be more frivolous about it, I think probably I'd want to take a juniper with me and hope that there'll be a bit of grain about and I could spend my time learning how to distill gin to keep me going in the loneliness of being stuck out there staring out to sea waiting to be rescued.
I think that's a perfect idea.
Yeah, juniper communis, which is a British native.
There you go, I might have to sail out to join you. Well, thank you to Lynn for joining us today. I'm Rachel Forsyth, and this has been the Horticulture Week podcast. Make sure you never miss one. Subscribe or follow Horticulture Week podcast via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. If you are interested in producing a podcast with Horticulture Week, email us at hortweek@haymarket.com. A huge thank you again to Lynn. Goodbye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.